Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival's program, Let the World Move, Speculative Fiction from the Periphery. Please turn off your cell phones. My name is Namwali Serpell, and I'm an associate professor at UC Berkeley and a writer. I would like to offer some thanks to the sponsors of this event, which include the Bay Area Book Festival, in particular Claire Calderon, and I would also like to thank the co-sponsors, the UC Berkeley English Department, in particular Professors Stephen Best and Nadia Ellis, and the Peripheral Futures Working Group led by Professor Donna Jones. I'm going to introduce our speakers and ask some broad questions to get the conversation going, and then we'll open up the conversation to you all. So I'll go in alphabetical order by last name. Leslie Neka Arima's stories have been honored with a National Magazine Award, a Commonwealth Short Story Prize, and an O. Henry Award. Her work has appeared in the New Yorker, Harper's, McSweeney's, Granta, and has received support from the Elizabeth George Foundation and McDowell. She was selected for the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35, and her debut collection, What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky, won the 2017 Kirkus Prize, the 2017 New York Public Library Young Lions Fiction Award, and was selected for the New York Times PBS Book Club, among several other honors. The New York Times calls her a witty, oblique, and mischievous storyteller. Alisola Kim, on the end, is a winner of the 2016 Whiting Award, the committee of which called her, quote, a writer of great nuance and tenderness, of mirth and mischief, who honors magic and is already a master of human idiosyncrasy. Her writing has appeared or is forthcoming in places like Lightspeed, Fantasy and Science Fiction, Strange Horizons, Tin House, The Village Voice, McSweeney's, Lenny, BuzzFeed, and the year's best science fiction and fantasy. In a review of Monstrous Affections, an anthology of beastly tales, the New York Times described Kim's story as described Kim as someone who writes with visceral urgency and distills complex emotions. Carmen Maria Machado's debut story collection, Her Body and Other Parties, was a finalist for several awards, including the National Book Award. The book won the Bard Fiction Prize, the Lambda Literary Award for Lesbian Fiction, the Brooklyn Public Library Literature Prize, the Shirley Jackson Award, and the National Book Critics Circle's John Leonard Prize. In 2018, the New York Times listed Her Body and Other Parties as a member of The New Vanguard, one of 15 remarkable books by women that are shaping the way we read and write fiction in the 21st century. Carmen just won a Guggenheim Fellowship as well. So I want to start by asking, what is your genre story? How does genre fiction first come into your life? Do you agree with the distinction between genre fiction and literary fiction? I know Carmen's got some thoughts on that.
Just a couple.
What is your dream for genre in the 21st century? What is your highest goal or aspiration for it? What do you think distinguishes speculative fiction in particular from other kinds of writing? And that question's open to everyone, but maybe I will start with Carmen because...
Oh, God. I've already forgotten. There were so many questions. I've already forgotten the first thing.
Okay, the question is just, what is your genre story? What do you think about genre fiction? How did it come into your life? And
genre,
what do you think about it now?
My root, yeah. It sort of happened in a few stages. I mean, I was one of those kids who devoured books of all types when I was young, and I had a particular affinity for fantasy and science fiction. Ray Bradbury was very important to me when I was growing up. I used to check out this, like, really beautiful collected Ray Bradbury book from, like, the 70s from my library. I checked that out, like, constantly, and I would read it. Which is actually, I think, also why I started writing short stories, because you don't really learn short stories in any meaningful way, in at least in public school. And so, yeah, he was sort of my exposure to that. And then when I was in college and I was writing, and I sort of was always writing, I kind of kept writing, but then when I got to college, it's interesting because I had a teacher I had a teacher who was very old-fashioned, and he was lovely, and he really helped me in a lot of ways, but he was very much, like, very sort of old-school realist, and he would assign me a lot of really wonderful books to read, but they were all sort of realist short story collections, primarily. And so when I got to grad school, that was what I was writing, and it was only when I was in workshop, and my classmates, who are now dear friends, said to me as gently as possible, "These stories are just uninteresting." or more importantly, "You don't seem interested in what you're writing," which is actually a thing that I notice a lot when I teach. You can tell when a student or when a person is not interested in their own, in the thing that they're writing about. And conversely, you can also tell when they really are interested in it. And they were saying, you know, throughout you just seem like you're just kind of like, you're just kind of, you know, you're sort of phoning in a little bit. But then there were pieces where it came alive. So in the case of this one truly dreadful story I had written about a young woman, I'm not even going to describe the plot to you. It's really awful. but there was a part where death appears to her in this hotel room, and they have this whole conversation. And then he kind of becomes this like beat of sound and like follows her kind of all over the globe. And they were like, "That's the part where the story comes alive. Like, you can see in that part, like, you suddenly become interested in your own writing." And then they were saying, you know, so here's who you should be reading. And they gave me this list, and they were like, "You should read Shirley Jackson. You should read Karen Russell. You should read Kelly Link. You should read Angela Carter." And then just sort of, and I you know, Helen Oyeyemi. And I just was like, "Okay, cool." And then I went and read all those people, and it just sort of like broke my brain open. And I suddenly realized I had this way of writing that really spoke to me. And then I kind of was off to the races, as it were. Do you want me to pause there, or should I also talk about? Should I answer all the things you said?
No. It's okay. Let's continue the first question.
Okay.
So maybe Alice, what's your genre story? Where did it first enter your life?
Yeah, sure. Carmen, I wonder if we were reading the same Ray Bradbury.
Did it have like ever rainbow covers, FSG?
Oh, no, not... Okay, it had rainbow letters.
Yeah, rainbow letters.
Oh,
yeah,
okay,
yeah,
really?
Yeah. I think it was the same one.
And it was,
one.
Like, a really big...
Yeah, it was, like, a huge hardcover.
Right, and it had some of his, like, really weird-ass stories, yep. Which, you know, aren't as widely anthologized, and which I found, like, super, I don't know, interesting and, I guess, maybe influential eventually. Yeah, I guess what happened is I always read genre fiction, and for a little while when I was young, I lived by a public library that I had to be at all the time for various reasons, and it was small enough such that like I could kind of like work my way through a whole section, especially when it was like, here's the horror section, here's the science fiction section. I think, you know, I read very quickly. I read a lot of duds, of course, but there was something that always kept me coming back. To the point where, like, it felt like, I don't know, my strongest allegiance was to genre fiction, although that's not necessarily true. Mm-hmm. And then I think I've never written a story or written any fiction that didn't have a speculative element of some kind, mm-hmm. or a non-realist element. And I'm not quite sure why that is. I think it does have to do with... you know what Carmen was saying about, like, where does it feel like someone gets bored? I think, like, somewhere along the line, like, I just kind of got... Brainwashed is not the right word, because I want... It's, like, a positive thing, but, like, somehow, like, my understanding of, like, this story is, like, what I thought was a story, part one, and then part two, what I thought was a story I wanted to write, would always be something that kind of verged on that territory, or was solidly in that territory. And so in college, I took my first writing workshop, and the thing is, like, I guess I've always been very lucky to have kind of one foot in, you know, it's not like distinct worlds, but for the purpose of talking about it, right, I can just be like, literary world, genre world, and imagine all the air quotes you want. I'm not going to keep doing them, but then one summer I went to the Clarion West writing workshop, which is a 6-week-long fantasy and science fiction writing workshop. So I've always felt very much both and neither, and right now very happy to be both and neither.
And so what was the experience of going to the Clarion workshop? What did that teach you about your feelings about genre fiction?
It was you know, kind of just amazing as just this, like, boot camp in a sense, because it was, It was 6 weeks, and each week was a different instructor, and there was workshop every week. So I suppose I got, you know, exposed to more than what I was definitely interested in reading, and exposed to sometimes it feels like in, like, let's just say, like, science fiction, it maybe because of this sort of, like, categorization mania, like, mm-hmm. this, like, urge to, like, self-name, like, what you're writing, it does seem almost, like, easy to kind of block yourself off into, like, well, I don't like space opera, so I'm not going to read that, and you can kind of avoid it, and et cetera. So in that sense, like, Clarion West was really valuable because I didn't do that, right? I had different, you know, instructors whose work I all read. I had, you know, all these different people who are writing different kinds of science fiction, as opposed to maybe like a college writing workshop where it might be like, there's a science fiction person and there's a fantasy person. You know, it doesn't get any more kind of fine grained than that. So I thought that was very interesting. Yeah.
Leslie?
I think that for me, so I grew up in a very religious household. And so I've always sort of like lived with the speculative, right? So, you know,
that first work of genre fiction, the Bible,
right? and so, I mean, like, and, you know, if you're, you know, if anyone here is, you know, comes, you know, has, you know, sort of like a deeply evangelical background, I mean, like, you know, people are casting out demons and speaking in tongues and being possessed by the Holy Spirit. I mean, like, this is, and so I always sort of had that, like, it was always just sort of a way that I interacted with the world. Like, yes, of course there are spirits and things like that. And even when I stopped being, okay, you know, I stopped being religious, it was still like something about the otherworldliness always drew me. Definitely with my reading, and I swear I'm not making this up, I also had a collected work, the collected short stories of Ray Bradbury.
I may as well say, me too. I mean, the illustrated man was mine. Like, that was my jam.
Mine was a bright red cover. But, so, you know, I was always interested in it, in my reading material. But, you know, I read, I'm no respecter of genre, actually. I read everything. So, you know, when we moved to the States, there was a sort of part of a spring and a summer, a spring where we weren't enrolled in school because, you know, it was like sort of like, immigration stuff to sort out. And so for that sort of part of the spring semester and for the entire summer, my sister and I pretty much just lived in the library. And we, you know, we each took one of my dad's duffel bags and we would check out, the maximum amount of books, which was 50, and like lug them on our little bony shoulders home. And then I would read my duffel bag, she'd read her duffel bag, and we'd trade duffel bags, and then I'd go back and do it all over again. I was no respecter of genres. I read everything. I even had a very unfortunate Louis L'Amour phase. But, you know, interestingly enough, when I went into grad school, that was not encouraged. It was very much encouraged, you know, it was like realist fiction was very much encouraged. But even my realist, so I write both realist fiction and speculative, and even with my realist fiction, there's like a thread of hyperbole in it, and I think of speculative as like hyperbole taken to its, like, you know, all to the extreme end. I've always been sort of interested in like the exaggeration that you can do on the page, however that manifests. As for when I started writing speculative fiction, intentionally, so it was, you know, it was essentially like a return to the work that interested me, and it happened like, you know, after grad school, and I encountered a story, Somebody's Baby by Diane Cook. It had won the Italo Calvino Prize that was then at Salt Hill Journal, and I remember reading this, and, you know, it's a work of speculative fiction, and I realized I didn't know this was possible. I didn't know that you could do this exact thing with words on the page in this way that is both a story that works on the surface level for entertainment, but also had like a thread of you know, social commentary in it, and it was just, you know, that story is really it's really fascinating, and her entire collection is fantastic. Man versus Nature, I highly recommend picking it up. And so, you know, I read that, and I was just like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And so I took a break. I took a break for a couple of years where I did not write anything. I was also helped along to stop writing by The Book of Night Women by Marlon James, which I read, and I was like, why is anybody even writing anymore? He's done everything with this novel that everyone has ever tried to do with a novel. Why are we even here? And so, I had like a bit of an existential crisis. And so I said, okay, well, I don't know as much as I think I know. And so I took a break from writing, and I just like went back to that sort of that reading that I did when I was a kid, like reading one thing after the other, no respecter of genres or anything, and just sort of exploring as an adult the possibilities of what fiction could do. And so when I finally did start writing speculative fiction, I felt like I came home. Essentially.
Mm. So all three of you write in multiple speculative fiction genres, right? So, the words, you know, as Alice said, the categories always like make my tongue curl up in disgust, but it's like, there's the magical realist mode, there's the fantastical mode, there's the science fiction mode. Do you ever start a story and it changes genre on you halfway through, or do the stories come to you in their genre?
I've definitely had the experience of a story shifting on me, but also a lot of the writers who I like the most are writers who are often engaging in more than one genre mm-hmm. at a time. Mm-hmm. So like Kelly Link, who I know mm-hmm. like is, Alice and I both are like big fans of, like I feel like Kelly's work is work that just is, it really does not give a fuck about what genre it is. I mean, it's just, it just like moves in this way and it's so effortless. And I mean, Kelly was another writer who like, when I read her work, I was just like, I didn't know you could do this. What is even happening? And yet I love it. It makes so much sense, even though it makes no sense at all. And there was just something happening on that she was doing that was really brilliant. Mm. So yeah, I've always liked work like that. That really, I mean, it's funny because Kelly, I've also heard Kelly say that the definition of like genre fiction is fiction that offers a specific kind of pleasure, which I think is a very interesting way of thinking about it. And I think that, you know, different subgenres or different kinds of speculative genres like offer different pleasures. And so it is possible to like, kind of sort of, you know, gather them up and have them in one story or move between them. So like, yeah, so like when I wrote Especially Heinous in my collection, like that's a story that shifts genres or uses different genre tropes in different ways because I thought it would be fun.
Can you sort of expound on that a little bit? Tell us a little bit about that story and what genres you think it explores?
Sure. So I mean, so to start off, it's Law and Order SVU fan fiction. So it's the first 12 seasons of Law & Order SVU. I took the titles of the episodes, and then I wrote an alternate narrative for Benson and Stabler. They let me do this in a magazine and in a published book. It's pretty amazing that I got away with it. But so to start off, it's fan fiction of a kind, right? I'm taking this existing universe and narrative, and in my case, sort of exploring the way in which we consume narratives of sexual violence and sort of what that does to us, because it's a question that I often had asked myself as somebody who was like a big fan of like Law and Order SVU and was like, can I be a feminist and also watch this much Law and Order SVU? I'm not sure. But yeah, so that story sort of was directly engaging with that, but also there's aliens, there's demons, there's doppelgangers, there's ghosts, there's girls with bells for eyes who are like ghosts of girls who have been killed.
Did everyone just feel a chill? Because every time I think about that, I get a chill.
Well, even more chilling is the girls with bells for eyes came to me in the shower. Like, I was just, like, shampooing my hair, and I was like, oh, the ghosts have bells in their eye sockets. Don't know where that came from.
Yep.
Don't really care to ask.
Yep.
So that was a story where, and I mean, again, the story is very expansive, and it has a sort of fragmentation to it, so it does sort of allow a lot of different genres. But it was really fun to be able to kind of like move between them and just sort of do what I wanted and just be like, cool, like, yeah, I could, I'll, okay, so, and actually the doppelgangers happened because I mistyped one of the characters' names. I mistyped, so there was Benson and Stabler, who are the main detectives, and I actually mistyped one of them as Henson, and I was like, oh, Henson, I was like, oh, Henson and Abler, doppelgangers, and then I added a whole set of doppelgangers.
Happy accident.
Happy accident, yeah, so I feel like there is this, for me, it feels like this very gleeful, it's sort of like running through a grocery store and just being like, I want some of this, and I want some of this, and I want some of this, and like, that's how I write. I don't know if it's the most efficient or way to do it, but it's just sort of how I do it, so yeah, and so I just like when stories can accommodate different sort of genre modes within the story, or like a collection.
Yeah.
Genre has, you know, also has like different modes within it, which is why like Leslie's collection I'm like really obsessed with, because I feel like it, I remember reading it and being like, I loved how it like shifted modes kind of constantly. Mm.
Leslie, did any of those stories come to you originally in a different genre, or did they come fully formed in their genre?
Yeah, fully formed would be very generous initially came to me. But I mean, I think that the only story that sort of that surprised me a little bit in that way was Glory, which is ostensibly it's realism, but so I wrote it there is this concept in Igbo cosmology where like there's your chi, and your chi is not exactly your soul. Your chi is like the sort of the spirit version of you that negotiates with the gods on your behalf to decide like what sort of life you're going to have. And so I knew I wanted to write a story about you know, a woman with a chi who was like asleep on the job, and so you know, but I wanted it to, but you know, it's realism, but like realism in the way that realism in the way that Christian fiction would be realism, in that it is but not really, right? And so like this was like something that was. So that was sort of the background, but I didn't want the speculative part to be so
prominent.
So on its face in the story, it was just my own spark. But then, about 2/3 of the way through, like this fable intruded, and it's a story that the grandfather tells to Glory to sort of galvanize her, and that was a surprise, and that I felt like it's almost like. There was something building up, like I had dammed it up, and it just needed to come out in some way on the page, and so it sort of worked its way there through this fable.
Okay. Yeah. Alice, yesterday you mentioned that you wanted to write a time loop story, but you wanted to kind of change it up a bit, and so I'm curious about whether, do you ever start a story with a genre in mind like that, like a genre concept that you're experimenting with, or do you, and alternatively, do you ever start a story and then the genre comes to you halfway through?
I think I most often start with the genre concept, and in that sense, it's not like I ever think about a story as, you know, being one genre and then possibly changing into another, you know, partway through the writing process. I just think of it as stuff, you know, like the supermarket sweep, right? Just but it's all just like, you know, time loops, doppelgangers, right? You know, magic spells. Like, it's just all this stuff that I obviously, you know, care about and am interested in, but I want to, you know, transform it in my own way and work on it.
I want to get into some pretty intense craft questions now. Since we're talking about, you know, the opening process or the process of writing, which genres you throw in your cart, which genres kind of side sweep you halfway through. When you have a sense of the genre that you're working in, do you set rules for yourself? Are there rules that you feel like you need to follow in genre fiction, or are there rules that you purposefully break? And how does that actually manifest when it comes to world building and plot construction?
That's a good question.
Is it?
So, you know, I think it's, so, you know, a lot of, responding to craft questions, like a lot of this is like reverse, I can reverse engineer it because right. I don't necessarily think about it consciously while I'm doing it, but I can look back and say, oh, that's what I did. So that's what I'm going to do. It's not that I have rules that I try to follow or try to break, but I like to sort of, what are the ways that I can exploit logic to fill in a story? And so if my premise of the story is, for example, like the title story of my collection, where, you know, people have the abilities to remove grief from the human body. So if that is my premise, that is sort of like the linchpin, right? The thing that's working in the story for plot. Well, what, like, I ask sort of explorative questions of that in order to think about ways that the story can go. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for example, okay, yes, if we did somehow discover a mathematical formula that allowed us to remove grief, the first thing we do is monetize it, right? Mm-hmm. Because humanity is generally, you know, terrible in that way. And so that gave me something to, gave me a direction to go in. So now my character is somebody who only does this for money, mm-hmm. right? And so now this, and she's at odds with people who think that this is something that should be like donated. Like it's a public service, essentially, that you have this skill. Mm-hmm. And so by asking myself that question, just questions about, you know, what are the, essentially applying human nature to this inhuman concept and just seeing what happens, it allows me to sort of figure out where the story can go by exploiting the logic. Yeah. That particular story started with, and I'm really sorry about this, it's very woo-woo, but I had a dream, and I sort of woke up, and I didn't remember a lot of the dream, but I remember that the dream was like, you know, people could fly, and a man fell, and I sort of wrote in my, you know, notebook, you know, oh, like, just so I wouldn't forget, like, what does it mean when a man falls from the sky? And then I started essentially asking questions that would make that make sense. Mm. And so different elements of the story just came from, essentially interrogating that, that question, you know, good cop, bad cop, that particular question, and seeing where, you know, like, okay, so if people can fly, what does it mean if people can fly? Well, not everyone can fly. Let's make it just one guy who can do it. And just like, you're sort of like, you know, asking these questions. And so one thing that I do, sorry, I've been talking for very long. One thing that I do think about when I, with writing speculative fiction is whether, like, the dynamic of the character, whether they're going to be an outcast or an outsider. And an outcast is somebody who is part of that world but chooses not to participate in it for whatever reason. And the outsider is somebody who is new to that world. And that sort of explodes the entire, like, that changes how you approach the page. It changes the questions that your character asks, and it just changes the language, whether it's a language that that signals like habitualness or a language that signals newness. And so like that is like part of the crafty questions that I think about.
I'm going to use your really good answer to rephrase my question and ask about it, like, instead of rules, maybe the idea of an internal logic, right? Because rules sounds like externally imposed and fixed, totally. But like an internal logic to a story, I think, again, plays with similar questions.
Yeah, and it's funny because we were talking about this yesterday, and I was thinking about, because you asked the question about the husband stitch, how like there were different ribbons, mm-hmm. the women had different ribbons, and I feel like this idea of like asking yourself, sort of interrogating your premise and letting yourself kind of instinctually answer the questions is actually a really, really good way to do it, because I'm less interested. I mean, some writers do write these like really incredible novels and stories where there is this like entirely new world and they've sort of, you know, logicked like down to the very last detail, like the way the world works. And I have great admiration for that. I think that requires a lot of work. But I don't want to do that work. it sounds exhausting to me. So this, actually, it's funny. So you were talking about this questioning thing. There's this game that I was given for Christmas last year that I really love. I think it's called just called like Cults, and it's like this game where you, it's sort of like Apples to Apples, where like you, two people like get like some cards that are prompts, and they create like a fictional cult from the prompts. And then they have to, then there's a person who's sort of the, who gives points, and they have to say like, I'm not advertising for the, for these people, they're not paying me. It's a really fun game though. But so yeah, so they have to ask questions. They'll be like, well, how did your cult start? And like, you know, and they just sort of ask these questions, and you have to just answer like off the top of your head, and then they kind of award points depending on how good the answers are. And so what's really fun about it is it's sort of this improvisational game where you are like, you get sort of these set bits of data, you sort of immediately create this thing, and then you have to answer the questions really instinctually, and what you were creating is a kind of internal logic. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's similar to how, I mean, I don't do it quite so literally, like I'm not actually sort of like making a list of questions, but I do feel like I'm more interested in, yeah, the sort of internal logic of the story. So for the husband stitch, like for the women with the ribbons, like I was like, I know other women would have ribbons. They can't all be on their necks because the husband hasn't seen them before. So like if every woman had a ribbon on her neck, he would know, right? And so the idea that like women have different ribbons in different places and they're different colors. But I don't have like this color means this and right. This location means this. It's just sort of like it would make sense that in the way that all women experience oppression, like there's intersections of oppression in different ways, like the ribbons would be in different places, right? Mm-hmm. And some of them would be visible, some of them would not be visible, right? And that just made sense to me. So I wasn't thinking about it as literally as like, here is the symbolism of the ribbons, but rather like, it just makes sense that that's how it would be. And so I'm just going to like briefly reference it to kind of give that question a little bit of fleshing out, and then that's sort of the end of that.
And readers in 50 years will write dissertations with color
totally.
Coding.
People ask me,
ribbon means.
That is probably the most common question that I get is what are the ribbons? Like, why is the ribbon green? The ribbon is green because the story that I read, the ribbon was green.
Right.
You know. I could give like a much more like symbolic flowery answer, but that's like the answer. You know, and like they're like, why does a woman have one on her finger and why is one on her ankle and why is it red and why is it yellow? I'm like, I don't know.
It's so funny. You know, I think readers ask those questions, but if we gave you the answers, you would not be happy. You would not be satisfied with that. Alice, could you talk a little bit about how you build internal logic or defy internal logics in your stories?
Sure. I guess like a lot of it is I'm always thinking about what will please me, and that's a very like ineffable personal answer. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of like writing what I want to read, even though sometimes I find it very painful to read my own work. But you know, in like the most kind of vague general sense possible. So I think about like genre and especially like concepts of genre when I'm writing a story that revolves around them in sort of a self-conscious way, where I'm thinking about sort of, you know, pitfalls and traps. This is why writing is hard, or I find it very painful. But like, you know, I talked about this yesterday, where I, you know, have often been irritated by a very, like a very superficially allegorical kind of one-to-one correspondence with like the metaphor and then the thing, and you know, that is, you know, the trope or the concept or something. And the example I used was every episode of like season one of Buffy, right? Where, you know, if you feel invisible, you will turn invisible and it will be very sad. I think like we've all moved on past that. And you know, for me, you know, surprise or kind of unexpectedness, I think it's sort of like an unseemly pleasure in a way, like, you know, O. Henry twists and all that, but it's still something that I think you can still marshal and you know, use the power of that. So I'm always, thinking about sort of ways to surprise with a concept, which also has to do with like how people work in genre, I think, too, because we're all very conscious of like what our boxes of toys are and what we have available to us and how it's sort of important or just interesting and playful to make those toys look different or to use them in different ways.
Do you think there's a possibility for a new genre of speculative fiction to emerge in the 21st century?
I don't like any of the new genres people have come up with.
What are some of those?
I don't like the names. I don't like hope punk.
Oh yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry to all of you utopians out there.
I'm sure I would like Hope Punk stories. I just, you know, so any new genre, right. I can't do it. I can't read that.
All the cool names are taken.
Yeah.
Right.
Leslie, do you think there's a possibility for a new genre?
You know, I can't imagine what it would look like, but there's always that possibility. I mean, it feels, I don't know, like, I feel like, you know, we are, especially in this particular moment, and, you know, of course, speculative fiction has always been around, at least it has been around for a very long time, but it has evolved.
Yeah.
And so, you know, even like, so like a space opera is a new thing. It's like newish, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, you know, created in like what, last 60 or so years. And so, like, who's to say that there isn't something new out there that just people have not thought about yet, or somebody has not, or maybe something that somebody has done that has not been done enough to be named yet,
named,
right?
Yeah,
and so, yeah. So I think like that would, it's very, very possible. I just wanted to, I need to get the name of that game from you, because starting a cult is my retirement plan.
Okay, well, this will help you get started, figure out what you want to do.
I mean, maybe I'll follow that thread a little bit and ask if there are other media, like games or, you know, card games, but also I know that Carmen and Alice are making their works into TV series, right?
I have a movie option.
Yeah. And then Carmen, yours is a series, mm-hmm. right? And so could you talk a little bit about how you feel like genres work with these different media?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, the show is very much still in progress, and I'm not writing it. I'm just sort of consulting on it. But it's
Would
funny
you want to write it?
What was that?
Would you want to write it?
No, I don't know how. They were like, do you want to write it? And I was like, I don't know how to do that thing, so why don't you write it, and then I'll give you my thoughts about the script. But it's actually been really amazing, and the writer who's working on it is fantastic, and she's really brilliant, and really kind of gets to the point where she showed me something once that, you know, because the book that I wrote doesn't fit neatly into a TV show, so you know, you have to do some stuff to it to make it fit, and she had taken one of the stories and made it into an episode, into a script, and there was this stuff that she had added, and I was really amazed because, like, if you didn't know that I hadn't written it, you would have thought I wrote it.
Oh,
because, like,
wow.
It was like, completely, like, in the tone of the rest of the story, but it's not from the original story. It was this whole new thing she created. And I was like, that's how, and then that she's good. That's just that good.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, you know, she's the expert. But I think that it's really interesting also thinking about, because, you know, prose, like, I love, like, as somebody who, like, loves movies, loves TV, loves video games, like, I love all those things. And I think they offer a lot of different stuff, you know, narratively speaking. But, you know, prose offers a very specific experience that I think is hard to, you can't really reproduce it you can tell stories that are similar, but TV and film, TV and pro, you know, or, you know, what's on the screen, like a visual medium, and prose are never going to be exactly the same. And I think that's really interesting. And so there are challenges to thinking about it visually.
Yeah.
You know, because the interiority is not as clear in a piece of, in like a film or an episode of television. There's also actual, like the fact that I have Launderer fan fiction in my book is like fine, but it's way harder to reproduce that for the screen for obvious reasons. And so, just go kidnap Mariska Hargitay.
Exactly.
Me and my TV show.
It would be amazing if she said yes.
And, right. Oh, it would be amazing. If anyone knows her, call me. I love her. Anyway, but yeah, so it is kind of interesting to sort of watch, and again, it's also interesting to be watching it kind of from a little bit of a distance and sort of seeing the way that someone kind of works that. And I don't know, I think it's super interesting.
Alice, have you encountered any of this kind of medial differences in the process of getting this made into a film?
Not at all, just because it's just very early days yet. Mm. I was just shocked that people were interested in optioning it.
The story is the mothers lock your daughters?
Yeah, mothers lock up your daughters because they are terrifying. Yeah. And I think, mostly the conversations I've had about, you know, turning it into a movie have just been, you know, very speculative, very general, just like with studios who are like, we want to buy this. And some people really kind of engage with the subject matter, and some people are like, witches are hot right now. I thought witches were just hot forever, but I mean, I guess there's like a peak right now, so, you know.
I mean, Carmen, you mentioned yesterday that the...
Can I answer that question, actually?
It's still part of the same... So, sure. Yeah. You mentioned that the husband Stitch is not set in a particular time period.
Oh, right.
And so, you know, I'm curious about, like, casting decisions, costume decisions, et cetera. Sure. But then also, because I want us to start thinking a little bit about the fact that none of us are white, how that works with casting decisions for a story.
So I actually, when I was going through the process of trying to find a writer, I was also talking to a lot of people, and Hollywood people are fucking weird. They say weird things to you on the phone. I can't be half of them. Just really, really weird. And this thing that I, and you know, I actually was pretty chill. I was sort of like, you know, like, I recognize that when you make this into a TV show, you're going to have to do a lot of adaptation. I don't want to be precious about, you know, like, conserving, like, this sentence. You know, it's like I understand that, like, this is going to be a process of adaptation, and that's part of it. But I had this thing that I would say to every person I spoke to, which is, like, if you take this book and you make it a bunch of skinny white ladies, I am going to fucking lose it. I was like, that is the one thing that I will be really mad. And some people said some real weird shit to me that I'm not going to repeat. And some people said, and then this Gina, who ended up adapting the show, not only was she like, I totally 100% get it, but then she like went away and came back with a plan as to like how you would sort of, she says this as like, she is like a skinny straight white lady. And she's like, you know, she's like, here's my plan for like ways to subvert the normal casting bullshit that happens. And I was like that. And she was the only person who did that. You know, everybody else was just like, so they either said something really weird where I was like, nope. Or they would say like, sure. Yeah, that sounds great. And I was like, you were just telling me that. But she actually like kind of made this plan and it made me feel really good about it. And so that actually was something that I wanted to tackle really early on. I was like, I really, really, really will be so embarrassed and so outraged if that's what you do to it. Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, aesthetically, like, you know, pinning down, like, an era. Like, they'll have to choose something, right? For, like, the husband. They'll have to, like, pick a time. Because, yeah, it's supposed to be kind of nebulous, but, I mean, it feels very, like, old-fashioned. So, like, maybe they'll, like, stick it kind of randomly, like, I don't know, in, like, the 60s or 50s, which to me feels like eternity ago. So, like, that's, like, kind of maybe where it goes. And then we'll just see what kind of decisions they make. But again, like, I'm actually not, except for that one thing, I don't particularly care. Like, I trust that they'll figure it out, you know, like, they know what they're doing, so.
Leslie, you wanted to speak to
so,
that
yeah,
movie.
So I actually worked on adapting one of my stories for the screen.
Oh, wonderful. Which story?
The title story. Mm-hmm. And it was fun and excruciating, mostly excruciating, because they are very different mediums. And as much as I have, I can like, write visual language. In fact, writing the scripts was fantastic. I really enjoyed that, but having to decide. Like, where is the story actually going to go now? Mm. That was more complicated because, you know, I had only written, you know, I'd written a version that sort of came to me or whatever, and that I sort of logicked out, and I wasn't entirely sure how to fill it out. Mm. So, you know, so the trajectory of the season, it was a limited series season would end where essentially maybe right about where my story ended.
Okay.
So now what I had to do was, you know, there were all of these things that I very cleverly hinted at in the story that I now had to go to
and expand
and write about it. And I could, I could work out like the logic of the world. What was more complicated was, okay, so who are going to be the main players now?
Right.
So we have, you know, there's the main character, there's her partner, there's the father, but who else is going to play a major part, and what is their emotionally resonant arc that is going to happen at the same time that the story is arcing as well? It was very challenging. Mm. It was really challenging. And what I ended up deciding was that I would love to, like, provide, like, a sketch, and somebody else does all that work.
Huh. Yeah.
There's also an interesting element, speaking of speculation, where if they decide to do another season, it would be like not my book. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
What would happen afterwards? And I'm like, I don't know. That's right. Kind of interesting. It's like it's like taking in a way. It's like Carmen fan fiction, right? It's like I made a thing, and they're like, we took a thing, and now we're going to keep going, but like into this place that you didn't do. Like, you didn't do it. Like, you
right.
know, which is also kind of an interesting idea of like your work getting kind of passed off to this other artist, and then getting expanded and opened up in this way, which is just, I don't know, it's just really interesting.
And feels like something that would happen more with speculative fiction than with realist fiction, right? Although I guess they are doing that with Pretty Little Lies.
Well, I think it's so funny because I actually also just recently started sketching out the first sequel to one of my own stories, which came to me, like a character in 8 Bites, the daughter Cal, for those of you who've read it. I suddenly was like, oh, I kind of want a story from her perspective, but like not set at the same time as the other story. And I started actually writing it. That's not a realist story, but like it was interesting to sort of think like, what if I just like change the character up? And like, I'm just really curious. Really curious about like what her perspective, because you don't ever really see her. She's sort of off stage for most of the story. So I feel like, I don't know, like I think a lot of genres have the potential just like thinking about like, if we just switch this to another character, or we like just sort of imagine, like what are they experiencing?
Yeah. Alice, do you have any thoughts about the way that race plays into genre fiction on the screen?
You mean like as a continuation of the last question, or?
Yeah, I want us to move to like one final question as a panel before mm-hmm. we open it up to the audience, which mm-hmm. is going to be about the fact that, you know, the panel is titled Let the World Move, Speculative Fiction from the Periphery. And I want to talk a little bit about us as peripheral subjects and mm-hmm. writing in these perhaps peripheral genres, although maybe not anymore. I'm curious about whether you, and even if you have thoughts about the way race gets represented in genre fiction as such, not necessarily on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess just as a starting point, I was, with like the movie option, you know, which of course has like a 0% one chance of getting made, but it's still really cool and really got me thinking about sort of that translation. And I, you know, also really wanted to be hands off, because if it was to be a movie, it would just be a new thing, you know. And the more that I like, especially for me, the more I would maybe want to force it into being something like the source material, the worse it would get, you know. Mm. But of course, it was very important to me that, you know, there are 3 main characters, and they're Korean-American girls who are adoptees. And, you know, each conversation I was like, but, you know, do anything, but don't change that. And, you know, it was almost sort of like half a joke, because I almost felt like it's just so inextricable
from
the story that they couldn't. But, you know, on the other hand, yeah, I'm like, there's nothing they won't do. So, and I guess, you know, it would really please me to see that story be made for obvious reasons, but also because, you know, there's something I wanted to get at just about Korean-ness or Korean-American-ness, which is not like kind of a monolithic sort of like way to be or thing even. But, you know, I was just like, okay, there's also like farts and laughter and anger and everything happening in quick succession at once, and like all of these like kind of like feelings that are very intense and sloppy, and a lot of that felt like kind of both like personal, just in terms of how I go through the world, you know, farting and crying, but
at once,
yeah, something like I recognize from like, you know, Korean cinema and sort of people I've known, just very kind of like wafty and ineffable, but it would give me joy to see that captured and not just this person is Chinese. They came from China and they have this one problem that relates directly to China. I feel like that often happens when you do see like a person of color or people of color in at least bigger Hollywood films.
Yeah. So I'm going to read a few quotes so that we can talk a little bit more about this. So the quote that inspired the title of this panel is from Toni Morrison. Quote, I stood at the border, stood at the edge, and claimed it as central. Claimed it as central and let the rest of the world move over to where I was. And Toni Morrison writes speculative fiction. It doesn't get talked about much, but she writes horror fiction and she writes the gothic, she writes ghost stories. And she is also a black woman who is extremely clear about her black womanhood and its relationship to her writing. So a couple of quotes from the three of you. Leslie's bio says, she was born in the UK and grew up in Nigeria and wherever else her father was stationed for work. Alice's biography calls her, quote, a left-handed anchor baby, currently residing in New York. And Carmen doesn't have any mention of this in her bio, but wrote an essay for the New York Times about visiting Cuba with her little brother. Carmen's grandfather is from Cuba. And she described Cuba this way, for us it was liminal and we were liminal in it. So I want to ask a question that doesn't fall into what Alice just mentioned, which is the one-to-one I am of a person of color from a particular place. I write about that place, and it has relevance to a specific set of issues about people from that place. What I want to ask is whether being from another place or having a dual identity, a liminal identity, a movie's identity, has anything to contribute to your writing, whether it affords anything for you as writers of speculative fiction, whether it blocks anything for you as writers?
I would say that the, you know, sort of the more, the further away you are from center, right? It's sort of like the more ways in which you are different, the more ways you have to learn how to navigate the world. And so, you know, so for example, I am very interested in power and how power manifests, like social power especially, how that manifests, larger questions of power too, but just, you know, smaller ones too, like interpersonal. And it's something that I always think, like I'm just always thinking about it when I'm writing because, and like, you know, not consciously, again, reverse engineering, but it always, because it's always happening. Every time we interact with someone else, there is an exchange that happens, and oftentimes, especially within an in-group, right? Within an in-group, that particular navigation of power becomes even sort of more subtle and interesting, because now it's not like a disparity necessarily in race or in class or whatever. It's essentially, it's, you know, people who are largely like each other, but then how does power work in that space? Mm. And so just sort of being somebody who is both sort of subject to power and has power that I can also subject, it's, you know, it's like a interest, it's essentially asking about human nature, because how we sort of exert or react to exertion of power is, you know, it speaks to who we are as people. And so because it's something that I have sort of had to navigate my whole life, and navigate in a way that I was very aware of, that I was navigating, you know, in these various extremes, race, gender, class, etc. it's something that it's an interesting space to explore, and it has sort of provided me with a lens almost that I can that I sort of see the world in, see the world through, and see how stories work. Because I have probably do another whole panel about how stories are essentially a question about power, but I won't go so far into it. But I think of you know, when somebody writes a speculative fiction and you know, people say, oh, it seems so real. And I think of like what made it seem so real is that regardless of how fantastical the world is, there is something true about humanness that was captured. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the setting can be as outrageous as possible, as outrageous as a writer can imagine, but the question of human nature, which is again centers all these issues about like social power, is what makes it quote unquote universal, or what makes it feel true, because we all, even if we're not conscious of it, we all understand how power works. We all understand how social power works, and so seeing it recreated in a fantastical setting, like it rings true to us because we all internally know how that works.
Mm. Yeah. Carmen?
Yeah. So it's interesting because I feel like my relationship with the periphery and with the liminal and my own identity, it really depends on what part of my identity I'm sort of thinking about. Mm. So for example, in terms of my gender, like I feel like I think of women as very liminal in terms of the way that we exist in the world. Like we are sort of doubted as a matter of course. We're not taken very seriously. Our value kind of shifts up and down very quickly. Our rights are kind of constantly under attack. I mean, and so I feel like that liminality for me like comes through very clearly. But then when I think about like my racial identity, it's also feels very liminal, but in a totally different way, which is, you know, as somebody who is a person of color who does not really present that way and who is constantly getting asked and sort of tested, and as somebody who like, so I was saying yesterday, like, you know, my kid brother and I went to Cuba, and my brother speaks Spanish because he was in the Peace Corps. I don't speak it very well because my dad didn't teach me, because my grandfather did not teach him. And so this sense of like linguistic alienation that happens. And I remember one time, the first time I went out to lunch, I was new to Philly, and I met this woman at the local, I was belonged to an adjunct union, and I met her, and she invited me out for lunch, and we were talking, and she, at some point, sort of stopped, and she's like, what are you? Mm. And I was like, and she was like a biracial woman. Mm. And I said, well, I'm Latina, like my grandfather is from Cuba, he's not white. And she was like, and I was like, well, most people can't tell. And she was like, oh, I could tell. And I almost burst into tears, like in the middle of this lunch, because I had just never heard anyone say that to me before. Mm. And so I feel like, so it's funny, and and in some ways I wrote this story in the last year. It's the first time I've ever written really about race in my work, at the center of this long sort of novella is this young woman who in France in the 30s, who is not white but does not exactly know what she is, and everyone's kind of always asking her, and there's just this like weirdness, like she exists in this like non-space where, because her mother has died, and her mother, you know, she has a lot of questions that she can't really answer. Mm. And it was the first time I ever sort of like put my feelings about that into fiction. And before that, I think I hadn't really written very explicitly about race, just because I was a little scared, I was a little nervous. I wanted to do it justice. I didn't want to like fuck it up. Mm. I worried about the authenticity of my own experience, and like, you know, and that was like very anxiety inducing for me. And it still is. I mean, even writing that story was terrifying. Mm. So I feel like in that sense that liminal becomes less about like, it's even more about just like, where am I? Like, what am I exactly? And like, putting language, like trying to find language to put to that state of ambiguity and that state of liminality. I mean, and that's the kind of fiction that I like writing anyway. So it's like, well, it just seems like perfectly suited to sort of match them up.
So we're going to take questions after Alice responds to this. I think we've been asked to have people line up behind someone who will have a microphone so that they can ask the questions into the microphone so that it comes up on the recording. So prepare your questions, and if you are interested, you might start lining up now. And Alice, you mentioned in your last response that the Korean-American experience felt inextricable from that story. Is that true for a lot of your speculative fiction?
I think it started to be. You know, there was definitely a point at which I stopped writing about white people so much, from the point of view of white people, or, you know, just kind of left it general and blank, but, you know, secretly white. You know, I really definitely stopped that. Mm-hmm. And ever since, even when it's not, even when, you know, things like class and just, you know, class, race, gender just aren't, or don't feel like maybe the exact focal point of the story, I can't write it any other way, you know, to be like non-ignorable, you know, I can't write it so that it is ignorable. I guess I was always doing that, except for the white people thing. When I was 10, I wrote a book for a school project that my mom just found, and she was very excited about it. And I think like every kid in class had to like write these books, and then you kind of like made these fake little covers out of cardboard and wallpaper samples. Anyway, it was about this woman who visits a shop that's full of dolls. They're very scary, and they come to life at midnight, and then they like attack the woman and the store proprietor. And I did remember that. Also, the most fantastical thing about this story, it occurs to me, was that there's a doll shop open at midnight.
I was gonna say.
What is this? Like, it would just be easier to switch to mail order. Anyway, right. So I sort of remembered that I did that. And then I actually, like, you know, visited home, and I saw this book. And what I didn't remember is that this woman who gets stuck in this dumbass doll shop is just waiting for the bus, because the bus just isn't coming. And, like, every other page, I'm like, the bus just wasn't here yet. And then the other thing was that she keeps asking, like, how much is that doll? How much is that doll? And saying, these dolls are too expensive. I will not buy any.
Class consciousness at an early age.
Yeah, right. It's just always there. And just another quick thing about just, I don't know, liminality and being on near border, on the edge. Like, I think one of the powerful things I see about being in that position is, it's like a kind of a unique position from which to, view the world and therefore kind of see how different unlike things are like or connected or have like a deep correspondence. And so I just on a personal note, like I think about kind of the experience of being like deported and going back and forth between countries, and in that sense, like, you know, time travel and travel to other star systems and planets does not seem so alien, right? Mm-hmm. Or being an alien or being around other people who are all alien, like all of that feels like, you know, an experience that is not like wholly kind of remote and totally speculative. Like it right. Feels kind of like this perspective where I can kind of compare and combine them. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, you guys. And we would love to hear from you. So if you have questions, please.
What's the name of the game?
Oh, the cult game? I think it's just called Cult. But if you look up like Cult card game, I'm sure you'll find it.
There can't be too many.
There can't be two. That was so strange.
Hello. I had a question, since it sounds like a lot of you have a really strong background in academia, and the fact that you were probably kind of steeping yourselves in the genre canons, and looking at all of the tools that were being used that you could use in the genres. Did you find yourself kind of falling into the trap of wanting to do something completely different that nobody had ever done before, like throwing yourself against a wall trying to do something original? Or did you kind of have to specifically give yourself permission to play with the tools to try to create something that maybe just happened to be original?
Wait, sorry, are you saying, was it hard like in the academic setting? Is that the question that you're asking?
Well, I think, at least in my experience, after studying a lot of genre, you feel like you've kind of seen it all. So it feels hard to kind of try to contribute something that is different using those tools. So I think my question is, how hard was it to use the tools without feeling like you were making something that had already been made?
I feel like I think about genre, I think of it as a tool. Like, I think of genre and genre tropes. Like, I feel like there's ways to write in which you are sort of a servant to the genre, and I'm not as interested in that kind of writing. I'm more interested in people and writers and artists who use genre as a tool. Like, they are in charge, and they take the genre tools and they mix things together and they do cool stuff with them. Like, that's just, for me, that's just like more and more interesting. So I feel like I thought about it that way. I never felt like, oh no, I've reached like the limit of what this thing can do. I just was like, cool, now we'll just like add something else or, you know, try something else.
I actually did feel that way, maybe earlier on or even before I wrote. Like, I would kind of be like, well, what can I do? Like, this is so mind-blowing. Like, what could I contribute? And then, you know, sort of at the beginning of when I became a writer or just started writing, I think that it's also just, like, kind of part of it, of just getting more comfortable and getting more experienced. Like, I think about how much imitation I did and how, like, that was, like, both kind of a very useful tool and learning experience, but also like futile in the best way possible, because like, you know, it's never really going to be a perfect imitation. So in that sense, like you will always come out and that is different from who you're imitating. And in that sense, I think it doesn't matter if you write about like, you know, a haunted generational spaceship and someone else has done it, or like 10 people have done it. Because it's funneled through you. And like, I think that, you know, you sort of like gain this confidence in yourself and like the newness and the special quality that you bring to even an idea that people have seen like a million times before.
I must be really self-centered because I'm thinking, yes, other people have done it, but I haven't done it. So, and so I think that's what it's going to take. Because I mean, yeah, there's nothing new. Like, there's nothing. There's very little that's new. And so what you're doing is that you are putting, you know, you're putting your like sort of you stamp on this thing. You are using this thing to like write the story or whatever that's so specific to you that nobody else could write it, because you're the one who's writing it. There's no other you, right? And so I don't think that is something that you should worry about, you know, somebody else has done it before. Because yeah, it has, you know, it has been done before, and that's okay. You haven't done it before, and this is about like you and your craft and your writing and. And so, you know, like, yeah, be a little sort of more selfish and self-centered about it. So,
yeah. Amen.
Thank you.
So, kind of to piggyback off some of those ideas, you have all touched on this a little bit, but I'm wondering what kind of sparks your imagination. I think Leslie mentioned the Igbo concept of chi, and Carmen, obviously, Law and Order is super inspiring to you. But you also touched on the story of the woman with the green ribbon around her neck. So I'm wondering, is it specific mythos or folklore that you're inspired by? Is it just anything in your world that you're consuming, reading, watching, whatever, listening to? Where do you get those sparks?
Yeah, I'm pretty omnivorous. I mean, I watch a lot of TV. I play a lot of video games. And usually I'm like, I'm coming up with a story as I do this, right? And yeah, and I feel like I sort of have that appetite. Like, I feel like I'm sort of constantly, and I keep a lot of lists, so whenever I get ideas, I just write them down. And like, I mean, I could love to be 1,000 and never write all the story ideas that I've had. And I think it's just because, like, yeah, if you're like a person in the world, you're curious, you're consuming a lot of different kinds of like books and movies and whatever, like, you, yeah, like, you, it's giving you this thing to kind of bounce off of and jump off of. And oftentimes for me, it's like I'll feel a sense of dissatisfaction, or I'll be like, oh, I feel like there's more to this story, which is like in the case of the Green Ribbon story. Or it might be like, I love this thing. I wonder how I can take this thing and make it, and like, yeah, do like my own version of it. So yeah, I think that's for me, it's just like everything I encounter in the world. That's sort of how I feel about it.
I would also echo that, and I also keep lists. I have this. I highly recommend this. I feel like I lose notebooks all the time, or I like misplace them, but I always have my phone with me, and so I have this app called Blue Lines, and it's really great. It's a notes app that you can sort of have things divided by folders, and then within the folders you have documents as well. It's just really great. It really helps me to organize my thoughts, but I have a million folders, and within those folders I have like documents that just, one of them is just like a list of, a document titled Wordplay. And essentially, like, if a sort of an interesting turn of phrase occurs to me, I just put it in there. And so, there are probably up to 100 of those now, just like these little snippets, these sentences, or like little paragraphs, and I just, I just keep them. I keep everything, and I sort of document everything. And so even I have like a list of like, oh, short story ideas. It helps to keep me organized. And as for where the stories or the ideas come from, like with Carmen, it's just, engaging with like media and content out there in the world, books, TV shows, games. I'm thinking about, I read there was a line in Exit West where, he's describing a woman and her maid, and he said, and the maid has they're both the same age, but the maid appears a lot older because she's been working her whole life. And, he said, oh, it's almost as if the maid sort of like aged on her behalf. It's really sort of a lovely line, but I just thought, now there's a story. And there's a story where, like, you can essentially hire someone to age for you. And then I was like, oh, that's Altered Carbon. Someone already did that. But a little interesting phrase that sort of, like, tickles my imagination. And I just,
I could ditto also everyone else, and then I'll add just, like, a new source of, or a different source of inspiration. Although you guys both touched on this. Like, when I get mad and irritated with something, and often it is like a genre thing, like a sci-fi TV show. Bad episodes of Doctor Who are very inspiring. I'm like, this is horny as hell. but I like it enough to like care about it, but I'm just so mad, so I do find that inspiring. Also that film, Passengers, that really horrible, creepy film. Really, yeah, where what's his name? Chris Pratt is on a generational spaceship, and he wakes up Jennifer Lawrence because he wants a girlfriend, thus dooming her to a life spent completely with him on this ship, until they die. So I was just like, I want to not have this exist and have whatever I think of exist instead.
Can I ask a craft question? Like, how do you know that a story is done? Because, yeah.
How do you know when a story is done? And that's our last question.
I think that when you write, you have a vision of a story in your head, and when you're writing, you're trying to get closer to the vision, and at some point you get close enough. Whether or not you, I guess if you get there, good for you. You're real lucky. But, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. You're just reaching toward whatever's up here.
Yeah, there's no magic formula. There are stories where I thought they were done, and then something like something that feels unsatisfying about it. And so I sort of force it and say, okay, well, like, what could happen next? And then that takes the story further, and then I get to the real ending. But yeah, there's no special formula for you know. I mean, deadlines are great for figuring out when the story's done.
When your editor tells you, that's how you know.
Yeah, done because it's due. I agree with that. But also, I think I think of it more like it's maybe more important and also difficult to think about when a story is worth starting and working on. And for me, it's just having this sense of like richness, and that's why. Like both Leslie and Carmen were saying, like, lists are so wonderful because sometimes I will have this idea, it's a premise and I care about, want to work on, find interesting, but there's just, I don't know, there's this like, and again, this is very like woo-woo ineffable, like there's just a thinness to it. There's something that feels very like single and basic, and when I kind of, I don't know, have combined enough elements or just thought about it long enough to, you know, create that sense of richness, which is what I'm looking for, that's when I know I can finish the story and, you know, when it's due. So.
On that note, Leslie Neca Arima, Carmen Maria Machado, Alice Solakin. Give it up.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.